Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give us a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. I am going to introduce this gentleman, Richard C. He is a member of my home group, 545, here. And I've been looking forward to listening to his story, experience, strength, and hope. So I give you Richard.
Thank you all. Yes, thank you for being here. Taking time out of your busy schedules. That's a bad joke, I'm sorry.
Sure.
So I got that out of the way, because I'm nervous.
Nervous.
And I don't know why I got dressed up for y'all, but I want to look pretty. I don't know if you all know what a cicada is. And if you've lived in the South for any amount of time, you'd be ashamed if you don't. So it's a little bug that comes out every 17 years. It's taken me 17 years of sobriety. Later on in the program, you'll understand why. But yeah, 17 years. 17 years. And a lot of things led up to me being here tonight for you. Before I forget, I first came into this room, this building, this program, on a Monday night, just like you all. And back in the day, I was told to do 60 days, not 30, not 90. At a place called Peachford, which I now understand has changed names to some bunch of letters or anyway, I'm sure I can't have changed that much, except there might be a few more buildings spread out all over town. That makes sense because, you know, the world is a crazy place. And even without the burden of whatever it is that brought you in this room tonight, it's a lot. It's a lot. And I don't see it getting any better, but I'm getting depressed just saying those things. So let me pick up the story a little bit. I'm a first-generation American. My parents, who are, you can go back, I don't know how many generations, farmers. And they met as teenagers when the Nazis came to town in a little corner of France called Brittany. They survived that. And somehow, not just meeting each other, they realized they had these far-fetched dreams of, A, getting the hell out of France, because they made it out alive. Their souls were intact, their spirits were intact, and crossed the Atlantic Ocean for a couple of days on an ocean liner, and literally reinvented themselves. Some of you may have already tried to reinvent yourselves over the years. I don't know. Young or old, I don't think it matters. It's a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to do. But it can be done with support, with a lot of help, and not a little amount of faith. So I had a wonderful, thrilling childhood in Manhattan in the mid to late 50s. And it was a magical place. You can name all the tourist spots, and my brother and I felt that they were ours, personally. Central Park, the museums, the Staten Island Ferry. It was just magical. It was wonderful. And we lived in a community that was bustling, just like you read about the old melting pot. It was true. Working class. Nobody was better than anybody else. We were all struggling for the same thing, a better life. And if there were children involved, like my parents and my brother and I, a better life for them, no matter what it took. And then circumstances required us to move. And we ended up in the Bronx. And for the first time, I encountered a wall, small wall. But, you know, when you're 6 years old, a wall is pretty big. A wall of resistance and being made to feel different. Why? Well, first of all, when all the little kids ran up and swarmed all over me, because I'm the new kid on the block, first thing they're going to ask, what's your name? So, up until that point, I was called Dickie. And everybody just started laughing their asses off. And this to me was like, wait a minute. You're just as old as I am. Your clothes don't look any better. What's going on? And it wasn't until later I realized Dickie could be taken a whole lot of different ways. And, you know, I'm 6 years old. There's no way I'm going to associate Dickie from anything except the nickname for Richard, which my parents spent a lot of time bestowing on me. But once I got past that, and the fact that they didn't know what the hell a person from Brittany was, I told them that I was French, although that's not really true, because my parents instilled in my brother and I that we're Breton. People from Brittany are Breton. But in a big town, you got to be part of a big group. So French, they had heard, but they had never seen a French person before. It was so bizarre. It was Italian kids, Irish kids. There might be some German kids in there. But, so those initial feelings of, you know, uncomfortableness and you know, the six-year-old jitters, that passed, and I became part of a group of what turned out to be some very wild and feral kids. I kid you not. And this was way before the Bronx is burning and all that shit. Oops, I promised myself I wouldn't curse. Before crack, before hip-hop, before the Bronx was cool. And it was literally little villages. You got past one or two blocks, you were in a whole nother universe. And if you didn't hold yourself up in a certain way, you could have problems, whether you were a boy or a girl. I'm not talking about beatdowns, but, you know, words can be hurtful, just as much as fists can. But once I got the lay of the land, so to speak, you know, it was nice. I lived in a 5-story walk-up, which we had just moved from, so that was no big deal. Everybody seemed to be living in my apartment building, which was huge. It was just a big old rectangle with 50 apartments to each corner, and then there were, anyway, a lot of people. And everybody that was over a certain age would hang out the window all day. So if you wanted to do anything as a wild child, the boys more so than the girls, although there were one or two wild young ladies too, you had to go slip away. And if your mom was calling for you, for supper especially, she just had to walk down 5 flights and ask Mrs. Lee on the 2nd floor, "Have you seen Dickie?" "Oh, yeah." So it was that kind of environment. Warm, loving. There were rules. But it was a nurturing structure, as family and neighborhood should be. And it's not always the case for everybody. So in that sense, I was very lucky. But this is so hard. So my luck, if you want to call it that, kind of ran out. I was going to one of the better schools in the Bronx, or citywide for that matter. It was a Catholic school. Now, my parents were religious, but the reason why we moved to where we did was because of that school. Great education, and the teachers, the religious teachers, not the lay teachers, well, although some of them too, were old school. And if you got out of hand, and this is with the okay of mothers and fathers, my child gets out of hand, do what needs to be done to get his focus back on what it wasn't. Now, what am I hedging around? So we got beat up a lot. No joke. Whatever horror stories you may have heard about Catholic schools and their students, it's all true. My pain started in the 5th grade. Now, what was different about the 5th grade was up until that point, it was girls and boys. It was co-ed. Although that word wasn't being bantered around yet. A lot of things weren't being bantered around. I'm 67 years old. I've seen some stuff. I've done some stuff. But 5th grade through the 8th, and I also went to the school, high school, boys' high school. So from 5th grade to my senior year in high school, it was all boys. And 5th and 6th grade, I had the same homeroom teacher. And if you don't know what that is, Google it. I'm going to probably say that a lot tonight because, like I said, I'm old and you people might not know what the hell I'm talking about. So, for 2 years, I was sexually molested by my homeroom teacher. And not only myself, but about, I want to say 10, it might have been more than 10, but we could only nail it down to 10 of us. And once we whispered to each other over those 2 years our shared experiences, we never, never spoke of it again. And I'm talking over 50 years. And I can't speak for my other buddies. I can tell you that when I came to finally confronting what had happened to me, two guys were willing to speak up. Because I wanted to sue this bastard. Sue the school. Sue the parish. Because that was in the news. You know? Boston was a big story. And it's a story that still is in the papers, unfortunately. But it was a very hard thing. I felt isolated, but it was reassuring in a very bizarre way to know that kids, boys, that I had come up with since the first grade, because we all lived in the same neighborhood, walking distance, almost a 2.5 mile walk one way to school. No mass transit, although that came later. So, but yeah, none of us thought to say something, see something, say something. All that stuff, that just didn't exist. It was enough that it happened, and we were all going to have to just figure out a way to carry on. So, that takes care of years 10, 11, and 12. And then, because, you know, they say bad shit always happens in threes. So that's number one. Number two, and this was even worse. Number two, my dad, who was a waiter and worked his ass off. I didn't see him a lot because he worked hours when either I was in school or when I was home, he was working late. But he was always there. He was always there. For my mom, two loving people. And somehow he always found a way, every year, from the minute we hit the ground running in the Bronx, to take us somewhere on vacation. It might just be a couple of days. Sometimes it was a couple of weeks, whatever he could swing. My mom, stay-at-home mom. Stay-at-home mom. And all the virtues that entails. Strict, loving. Didn't let my dad get wild and loose unless it was on vacation, and then she cut us some slack. And we could see that it was great. Very affectionate. A lot of love in this family. So 1967 rolls around. I'm 13, my brother's 9. He won't be 10 for another couple of weeks. And my dad says, we're going to Long Island. Now, if you're a kid in the Bronx and your father says we're going to Long Island for vacation, that's like you just retired and you're going to Boca for the rest of your life. This is big stuff. Big stuff. I'm so excited. Holy shit. Anyway, I'll try to keep it to shit. There's no excuse being from the Bronx. I've heard that all my life. And he's from the Bronx. They don't know how to talk any better. I do know how to talk better. So there we are. First day. And we didn't go anywhere yet. But my dad went to the bungalow. Not far from the beach. We could walk. And there was an awesome train ride on the Long Island Railroad. And when that salt air hit, we were always close to the ocean. My people, and when I say my people, I mean my father, my mother, Breton people, are people of the water. Because it's almost like New England in Brittany, you know. So we always had a love affair with water. Day two, all planned out. As usual, my mom made a picnic, and my brother and I couldn't care less what my mom made because she let us run around and we would eat it all up, even if it wasn't our favorite stuff. But another thing that my mother let my dad have as a gift every time we went to the ocean, she would let him go off for 20 minutes. It was never more than that. And we'd always ask him, you know, when we started to talk to my dad as a person other than the father. And he became more of a, not a friend, but I can talk to this guy. He's still my dad, don't get me wrong. I gotta watch my P's and Q's. But if I have a concern or a question, he'll talk to me like, not a grown-up, but he made me feel like a grown-up when he would talk back with me. So he would get this 20 minutes, and usually he would just wander down the beach. As I got older, I think part of it was, I could be wrong, because I never got a chance to ask him. I think he liked to just take in the scenery. And yeah, if you know what I mean, and just relax. He could be a dude, not lascivious, you know, not a creep on the beach, but just a guy. And he could just exhale for 20 minutes. Not that he was uptight when he came back. He was always in a great mood when he came back. But one of the things that my brother and I discovered when we would go to the beach is that if there was a crowd on the beach, two things brought that crowd in. Something that was once alive and is now either dead or on its way to be dead that floated in to the shore. Or someone had drowned. So a crowd gathered, and my mother had already sent my brother and I to go after my father, which she had never done before. So I don't know if he was out there a couple extra minutes, but it was enough for her to say, go get your father. Jesus Christ, it's always something. So we see this huge crowd. Now I was tall. I was almost 6 foot at 13. My brother, not so much. And I had already run ahead of him because I wanted to squeeze my way in and see what's up. Again, I don't know what's going on. So when I reach the crowd, I hear someone screaming. And I'm jostling a little bit because there were, you know, there were some heavy bodies all slicked up with copper tone and what have you. I wanted to see. I've always been a curious child. That day was no different. And the screams persisted, I thought, for minutes. It might not have been that long. And then they stopped. And then the crowd kind of shifted. And lifeguards came out of nowhere. And then they came back all wet. And someone went out with a board, a bodyboard. And that seemed like an eternity. And I thought, God, am I going to see this person? Oof. And they dragged him in off a board. He was face down. And again, the crowd shifted. Because this is what crowds do. You know, you don't want to necessarily look, but, you know, we all do it. A wreck on 85. Somebody getting beat up in a bar. And then they flipped him over. And I lost my shit because he was my father. And I didn't realize it, but the whole time I saw them dragging him up, I knew it was him. Because, you know, I'd memorized his bathing suit. He'd worn it his whole life. He had the same suit the whole time that I knew him to go into the water. And I didn't realize it, but I was screaming. My brother was crying. And I'm just holding him to my chest, but I'm screaming. And out of nowhere, these two nuns in full penguin getup, black, I mean black, like shoes, not skirts, I mean to the ground black, and one of them starts talking about God, and I broke free of her, and I punched her in the face. And I'm not going to lie, I liked it. I liked it a lot. I tried to hit her again, but her two other buddies, I still can't believe that they were on the beach. They must have been sweating there. The little armpits off. They grabbed me, and I don't know where my mother was, but she appeared. Anyway, so we went out as a family of four, and literally overnight, we went back to our apartment in the Bronx. Now we were a threesome. What I didn't know, and I couldn't possibly know. I'm 13. I've done some crazy stuff. I've already had my first sip of beer at 12. Because I needed something that made me feel like I was a grown up. And at first I told myself, well, this will keep you from thinking about Mr. Lee, my homeroom teacher. But that wasn't really true. It started out to be true. And then unfortunately, our family was no more. We found our way through this void separately in our own 9-year-old way. My mother was 40. I'm 13. So let's skip ahead a little bit because I've got some more juicy stuff I want to tell you. So yeah, I developed this persona of, I'm going to find out what does all this heaven mean. Mr. Lee, my father drowning in front of me. If it was in a book, I was going to buy that book. Whatever it took for me to get my bearings and just carry on, I was going to do it. But what happened was I started to be everybody's friend. And I would listen to everybody. Strangers or people that I grew up with for years and years and years. And it was a skill that I thought was admirable, and it kept me from feeling sad. Although I was clinically depressed, I learned years later, just a few short years ago, actually. You know, well, shit, Richard, you were clinically depressed. I mean, I knew that, There was nobody around to tell me this. There was no grief counselors. There was no, there was no services for kids with that kind of trauma. Trauma. That was a word that wasn't bounced around yet either. But that's what it was. PTSD. Yeah. Years before Afghanistan and Vietnam. So, high school, I'm not going to lie, was wonderful. I'm drinking when I want. My mother's not finding out too often. I only got caught with the police in a car that I didn't even steal. But I got caught running out of it. And this is back when the cops, they knew all our names, first names, all of us. Now, I don't know if there were bad cops back then. I'm sure there were. But not like the way the media, and I'm not saying it's not real, but it wasn't like that, They were protectors, and our parents felt good that they knew us, and they had no problem with Officer so-and-so shaking me up or verbally accosting me. And my passion for reading wasn't diminished. I was a good student. I joined all kinds of weird groups for the moment, and then I get bored. And then I found myself in community college and wasn't drinking quite as much. But there were other lovely opportunities to get away from it all. And so weed, tie sticks, quaalude, magic mushrooms. Yeah, I can still get giddy talking about it. If I talk too long about it, I can almost get a contact high again. Which is not a good thing. But it's my life. And that's what you're here to hear about. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. And I'm not going to pretend that these things didn't happen. So, college was all right. I thought I was the shit. Because I was reading like a mad fool. Way beyond the syllabus for any of my courses. Except math. I couldn't stand math. I had to go to... Anyway, I'm talking way too much about... I was afraid of this. But you know, when you've been drinking for 38 years, y'all, it's a long time, and that's what I'm frightened about. How am I going to condense this without going off onto my story, certainly? But I see it's almost time for me to wrap it up. And so, college was all right, except... Now, if you've been paying attention, all bad things come in three. Have you noticed that? They always say that. They never say that about good things, though. He does some shit. So, my mother had saved up enough money when I was 23 to go to see my kinfolk across the pond. And I hadn't been there since I was 16. And that was pretty sad because it was like one big long wake for the whole summer, all over again. I said, I can't have this. Thank God I had a freaky first cousin. But anyway. You promised you're going to keep quiet. So... was a big cyclist back then. I kept my brain where it needed to be. Sometimes I would get high. Never drink. I'd have a puff puff. If I was going to be in a certain route or a certain section of the city where it's more fashionable to smoke your joint out in public than it is in certain other areas. And I says, Mom, I'm going to take my bike out before we head on up to the airport. We're all packed. We're all packed. And God bless her, except for the drinking nonsense, she said, okay, but don't be too long. No, no. I'll be back in half an hour tops. And I already had the route planned. So I had my little pipe, and it was trash. It was just a collection of like a dozen roaches, and I had smashed them all up and pretty much burnt it with the first toke. Got on that bike, and about halfway through I ran into a car, the back end of a car. Now, I had seen the car and never wore a helmet. Don't recommend it, although it wouldn't have saved me. But what I didn't know was when I took my eye off that car for a split second, and it doesn't take much of a physics comprehension, if you're going at a certain speed and there's X amount of space, in a split second, that space is gone when you pick your head up the way I did. So what happened was, he was drunk, and he overshot his driveway. Popped that bad boy into reverse. Split second went by. I'm huffing and puffing. I'm doing my thing, working up a sweat. Pick up my head, wham! So that's why I talk this way. So now, something that I've tried to hide up until that point, now you can see that I'm different. If I open up my mouth, which I couldn't speak for over a year, I couldn't eat solid food for 8 months. I had to aspirate myself for 2 months. And if you don't know what that means, Google it. I'm not going to get into it because I'm getting tense just thinking about it. But because it's either stubbornness or will, I get that from my mother. We're very willful people. And I had youth on my side. God damn, if I hear a doctor tell me that one more time. But it was true. And then, lo and behold, I came down to Georgia to follow an old girlfriend. That didn't work out. And then I discovered cocaine. I'll let you think about that for a second. All right, that's enough. Because some of you here have a more intimate relationship with that shit than I do. And that's fine. And I met my ex-wife, lovely gal, and like a lot of women, not all women, she saw me as a project. I was drunk every night, high every night, and that's how I met her, in this little dive bar. But I was a good boy. I was too old to be playing around. It's time to get serious. It's time to be an adult. Bing, bang, boom. Two kids. And my son was diagnosed as autistic. Now, this is back in the day before it was a thing. And most of the medical community didn't know what the F it was. We certainly didn't. So, a lot of bills. a lot of overtime, because that's what a man's supposed to do. I learned that from my father. The woman, she takes care of the home, the kids, but it was too much. It was too much for two adults, even with all the therapists. So that went to shit, and I've got a great job. I'm making the most money I've ever made in my life, and I've got a woman who can deal with me. She'd like to drink too. Go figure on that. And so I turned 50 in Memphis. I get shit faced because I thought if I could just see Graceland and Sun Studios, I could die happy. Heavy drunk. Unbeknownst to me, shortly thereafter, I woke up one morning, I think it was a Friday, grabbed a beer, and I was already high from the night before. I didn't even finish that beer, and I was loopy, and my brain snapped. And all the years of getting by, and you know, I'm not the worst addict out there. Am I a drunk? I don't know. Certainly nobody was telling me I was a drunk. Nobody. Nobody. Co-workers, no. They're all drinking too. And I snapped and I barked my ass on the front steps of our brand new townhouse. And I grabbed the knife from the kitchen drawer, and I just started slicing away. Except, because I'm a drunk and alcoholic, it was a bread knife. A goofy, barely an edge scallop. And I'm just whacking away. Goddamn. I must be really... fucked. I can't even break the skin, or if I have, there's no blood left in me. And by that time, two Gwinnett patrol vehicles rolled up, and 2.5 days later, I'm in Peachford, and not even, I think the third day was when I was settled in, had my meal plan. Had a job, very important for my sobriety. But it was a Monday night. I came in here, picked up my white chip. Lord knows where all those men and women, what happened to them. I know they didn't follow me. And I think about them to this day. And I don't want to, you know, make it weird for you, but... when I tell you there was nothing left to me, and I would have taken anything that would give me a smidgen of hope of getting my spirit back, my life. I thought I had a life. I lived a life. It wasn't all shit. It wasn't. But it turned to shit. And I knew 38 years was enough. There's no way I could do another day. No way. I didn't know if I could be a successful, sober person. But I was very willing. And so honest, it was crazy. And I'm only now, so 17 years, and I'm only now slowly coming into my own with imparting my experience to other people that want to hear it. A lot of you all don't want to hear it, and that's okay. and I hope you never get to the point that I had, that I got to. But if you do, there is a chance for you. And I'm gonna, I'm not gonna lie, it's, you know, I don't care what you've heard. Oh, it's a cult, it's religion, it's all this God shit. Yeah, it is kind of that stuff. But it isn't. It's what you take from it and make from it. And you all have that chance to make it. And from the bottom of my heart, I was hoping there'd be a few more bodies in the seats, but that's all right. That's all right. Good crowd. And thank you for letting me share my story, such as it was. And I apologize for, because I got a lot more to say. But hopefully, it won't take another 17 years of sobriety for me to tell my story again.
Take the air.